So thank you all so much for joining today's call and webinar. We're really grateful, and we know that folks around the country are doing amazing work on immigration reform and on media work as well. It's a really exciting time to be working on immigration reform. This is the time we've been waiting on. So we're all pretty jazzed. And this call specifically is going to talk about something where I think as the faith community, we have struggled a little bit. We have done amazing events. In my opinion, I know I'm biased, but I think we've done better events in terms of the depth of the events, the breadth of the events, than really any other group that's working on immigration reform as the faith community as a whole. But sometimes a lot of those really powerful events do not get picked up on by media, or at least by, you know, the mainstream media. And therefore, our events, even if they're powerful, even though they're fantastic and they're doing what they need to be doing, they're not really getting through the buzz, right? They're not being elevated to really get through to the public. And that's what we're going to focus on today, is how can we make sure that our actions on immigration reform are really lifted up and we can use media. Media is not a separate thing from what we're doing, but we can really interweave it and utilize media to make the most of our events and to really, you know, make sure that our events pack a punch, pack as big a punch as they can. So before we go into the media part of today's call, I wanted to give a federal update on what's happening with national immigration reform. And then I'm going to hand it over to Noel Anderson, who's going to give us a state update on what's happening on the ground. And there's a lot of good things happening all over the country. So in terms of an immigration reform bill, we are still expecting to see a Senate introduction of an immigration reform bill sometime between April 8th and April 15th. There are all kinds of different reports out there that it will be the 8th or that it will be the 9th or that it will be the 10th. I think probably I'm more comfortable just saying it'll definitely be between the 8th and the 15th. And that'll be on the Senate side. I know there's been some media reports on some shakiness on the part of Senator Rubio, but I think at this point the plan is still for all 8 senators in that bipartisan group to be introducing legislation. There were just some articles that came out today. I think they've been sent to the IIC listserv on some of the Senate and House bills and some of the specifics of those. And because they were just sent out like an hour or two ago, we don't have a lot of analysis on those articles or, you know, if we're likely to actually expect those things, but we will soon. So we do know, though, one thing that is very concerning. So one thing that we have heard is that the Senate bipartisan group of senators is planning to cut family categories. And this is not new. Unfortunately, in 2006 and especially in 2007, there were attempts to reduce, remove, eliminate, roll back, or completely replace family categories. And this year, in particular, we're hearing Senator Graham has been quoted in particular saying that it's likely that the sibling category and the adult children category will be replaced with what he's referring to as more merit-based visas and what we know will likely be employment-based visas or high school visas. This is really concerning to many of us. We all want to push immigration reform. We all want to support a pathway to citizenship and a good bill, but we really need to make our voices heard right now for family unity. And I would really encourage folks to go to our website, interfaithimmigration.org/family. We've created a whole page with family resources, some really good talking points on what's being proposed, why it's bad, why siblings and adult children are nuclear family. There's some really good biblical references from the Hebrew Bible and Christian texts about different siblings and adult children in the Bible and those powerful relationships, and to really lift those up. There's some good media resources. There's some good resources on immigrant women there. And we are also asking people to call their senators about this every week until we get word that, you know, they're backing off of this family proposal. Call your senators. We've said, you know, make Tuesday night family night. Call your senators every Tuesday. And there's some great resources on the website there. So I really want to emphasize, because there will likely be a lot of things about the immigration bill that we like and a lot of things that we don't like. And I think we're going to have to, as a community, really weigh our support. We want to be supportive. The time is now. But I will say that we need to weigh in, especially on the family pieces, now before we see legislation. Because after we see legislation, it's going to be a lot harder to walk it back. So if we can make our voices heard now really powerfully to the Gang of Eight senators and to our own senators, that for the faith community, family unity is non-negotiable. We cannot see a rollback of family visas, visa categories, then that'll be really great. And our number one talking point is this is not a zero-sum game. Congress should modernize and fix the immigration system by increasing both employment-based and family-based visas. You don't have to pit one against the other. And there was a great press call today, which we had the Episcopal bishop from Arizona and the Methodist bishop from Los Angeles area, Bishop Carcano, and Bishop Kirk Smith from Arizona, and Kevin Appleby from U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, along with President Trumka from the AFL-CIO on a call talking about this. So we sent out all that information, and it will be up at interfaithimmigration.org/family. But I wanted to give that update. And then there will also be a lot of folks here in D.C. for April 10th, and there's a big rally on April 10th and a lot of legislative visits. So if you're not coming to D.C., you can still make your voice heard by calling your senators, calling your representatives, and letting them know that you support immigration reform and that you support family unity. So I'm going to kick it over to Noel Anderson. And, Noel, if you can press *6 to unmute your line, you will be able to give us an update on all of the great state things that are happening. Noel, if you can press *6, it'll help to unmute your line.
Sorry about that. I forgot about the *6 trick.
So, no, you're great. We can hear you now.
Well, I'm so glad this call is happening because the ability to drive media is a really important piece of moving a target, moving a decision maker, and putting more pressure on them, and also rallying our base, letting our base know that the work that they do is valued in the public, and the larger public as a whole, and changing the narrative. We have had a lot of activity, as Jen mentioned, over the congressional hearing. We had 30 events and actions. Some of them were more educational. Others were real public actions in front of different senators' offices, and they're still going. So there's still events popping up. There was a lot of things on Good Friday, and a lot of stuff with Seder dinners as well, tying in the immigration theme. So keep up that good work. Keep those events coming. As Jen mentioned, April 10th, the Interfaith Immigration Coalition is helping put together the high-level leaders that will be speaking at the rally, including Bishop Carcano, Rabbi Saperstein, Reverend Gabriel Saguero, and CWS CEO Reverend McCullough. So we're excited about that, and we'll be trying to get them interviews. But we're really looking for you all to also be participating in these ECHO events. If you go to the website, you'll learn more about the April 10th event, and all of the ECHO actions are up on the website. I believe that is www.citizenshipnow. Can you correct me on that? I'm not in front of my computer, Jen, but that's a good address for you all to check out to know more about the ECHO event in your community. So with that, also I want to just really raise the attention real quick to the importance of things happening at the county and state levels, continuing to build at the state level policies that are immigrant welcoming is something that we need to, is an ongoing effort, no matter what happens at the federal level. And so it's important that we know that there's been some real progress on tuition equity. We see that moving throughout a number of newer states. Oregon has just passed the tuition equity bill, and I believe it's either signed or about to be signed by the governor. They're also pressing for a driver's license bill. I believe in Vermont it passed the Senate, driver's license bill there, and they're hoping they'll be able to move that. And that would be driver's license for all undocumented folk. And then there's some real struggles going on with making sure that DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, youth are able to get their driver's license. In North Carolina and a couple other states, they're trying to put these pink strips that say temporary status on the back. And so there's been some legislative struggles over that. And as in Georgia, there's a new bill that passed the Senate and the House and is expected to be signed by the governor that could make it much harder for DACA youth to get driver's license and also very difficult for undocumented people to get marriage certificates, which can complicate a lot of other processes and documentation and also with registering their children to school, etc. So there are some battles being fought out there at the state level. Trust Act to limit the secure communities is moving forward. I know Multnomah County in Portland just passed. The sheriff just came out with a policy that would limit the secure community sort of mass deportation program, as well as in Washington, Massachusetts, Connecticut, of course, California, where it started. Trust Act is moving forward at various levels depending on the state. So keep an eye on all of that stuff and keep on getting involved and see if you can be part or create your own ECHO action on April 10th.
Great. Thanks so much, Noel. And I am going to turn the speaker's mic over to Dan from Faith and Public Life. Dan, if you can press *6 to unmute your line. And Dan has a lot of fantastic resources for us that I always learn a lot whenever Dan talks about the media. I know it can be scary. I get intimidated sometimes, but Dan will make it really easy for us to understand how we can reach out to the media and that it's not scary and that really the media is interested in what we are doing and is a really fantastic resource for us in terms of lifting up the faith voice for immigration reform. So with that being said, Dan, I will turn it over to you.
Okay. Can you hear me?
I can. Yeah, thanks.
Okay, great. Well, first of all, thank you, Jen, for your kind words, and to you and Noel for inviting me onto this call. And everybody who is out there doing great work, I'm grateful for your leadership and all you do, and I want to help lift it up in the media. So I have a lot of ground that I want to cover, so I might move kind of fast, but know that we will have time for question and answer at the end, and as Jen said before, that all the slides that we're going to be going through are going to be shared afterwards. So with that, I just want to dive right in. And say the first thing that's important to remember about the media is that it's just another strategic tool. Media is valuable because it can help us reach targeted audiences with messages that advance the mission of compassionate, humane immigration reform. And that's to say that media is not an end in itself. Some events we do for the purpose of getting media coverage, but not everything you do is going to be magnified in a way, in a strategic way. So whatever you're planning your actions, think of the media component, but I would encourage you to not always approach your strategic work with the question of how can I get media for what I'm about to do. So I guess media would be like a second order consideration. So if you come to a point where you know that you do want to get media for an event, say it's a press conference or a prayer vigil or a march to an office, there's certain values and factors that you need to be aware of when you're trying to make sure that you have the best odds possible to get media coverage. Now, visuals. Having a visual element to your event is a really important consideration for the media. It can make the difference between a television camera crew coming and or not sending any reporters at all. So if you having signs and props and banners with our messages on them is an important thing because the visual element is actually their primary consideration. Studies show that newspaper readers look at the photo first, the caption second, the headline third, and then the story fourth. So they're thinking right away, can this have a photographic element? So those effective visuals, let's say you have signs and banners and props, they should be clear, very legible with thick letters and things like that, and immediately relevant to the issue. You know, I mean, if you're having an event calling for family unity, make sure that the signs are about family unity. I mean, that might seem very basic, but you'd be surprised how often people bring just generic signs to a more specifically tailored event. Now, another thing is that visual elements need to be understandable to people who don't have a religious background. So it's one thing to say my faith calls me to welcome the immigrant and the stranger. That's fine. Having just a Bible verse or another scripture verse wouldn't be intelligible to someone who's not from your religious tradition. So make sure that any signs or banners, you don't need to be scripturally literate to be able to understand. So besides the visual element, another news element that's important is timeliness. Doing an event or holding a press conference at a time when the media is going to be already predisposed to talk about our issue is really important. Now, fortunately, we are at the political moment right now where immigration reform and immigrants are going to be dominating the news anyway. So political relevance is one element of timeliness, and that's the factor that we have on our side right now. Whatever events we have in the coming weeks are going to be synced up with the federal debate. So that consideration is taken care of. Events in the past, like if you haven't had success getting media, one of the things in the way might have been if immigration was just not on the media's agenda. So in addition to the political relevance, other current events besides just the debate in Washington can provide a news hook as well. Like if there's an ICE raid at a factory in your community, right after that would be a great time to have a press conference or to put out a statement. Just whenever they're going to be talking about immigration anyway, for whatever reason, that's an opening for us to jump into. And the other element of timeliness can be times of symbolic significance, a holiday, like Noel mentioned, the Good Friday and the Seders. That's an example of a moment of symbolic significance that's apart from all those others. So those factors figure into whether we're going to get media as well. Now, beyond timeliness and beyond visuals are location. Where you hold an event should be someplace that is accessible to the media. Number one, government buildings, for instance, have a lot of press conferences there. One, that's because that's where the people you're targeting, that's where they are physically. Another is because you're legally allowed to be there, and news cameras know where those places are, and they know they can just show up, and there's going to be no logistical barriers to them being able to do their job. So government buildings and capitals are really good places to have events. Another good place to have events are at detention centers. So those are the places where the action is happening. Now, you can also have events at places of symbolic value, like memorials or monuments, or what I call the scene of the crime, like places where raids happen. So any place that you're going to have an event hopefully should be a place of greater significance or of symbolic or power significance. So those are our three critical elements. Another thing, and I realize I went out of order on the slides here, is another thing that can help make sure that we get coverage for media events is to involve, if possible, elected officials. If they're on our side, and if they're not in the midst of a scandal, and frankly, they're not the kind of person who just makes the show all about him or herself. So there's some advantages and disadvantages to involving elected officials, but they are magnets. If a council person comes or a member of Congress comes, they will help get the media there. So beyond that, the strange bedfellows. Like today, Jen was mentioning that the call had not only our faith leaders from the IIC, but also President Trump of the AFL-CIO. So having people who are not, you know, always standing next to each other, like even though we know that labor leaders and faith leaders are working together closely and have been for a long time, the media doesn't really know that. So they can say, oh, well, I didn't know those people were working together. Another example of that is we've all heard about the Bibles, Badges, and Business Coalition. That's another example of people who are not always working together on a day-to-day basis, coming together around a shared goal. And immigration is the best issue I know of for bringing together allies who are not on the same side of every issue. The different sectors involved, the different ideological groups that are involved, it's great. So that's a very fertile field for us. So beyond the strange bedfellows and the location and the visuals, let's say you've got all these elements that make it newsworthy. You're at a place where the media can get, you're at a time when our issue is in the news, and you have a compelling group of people who are standing together. Even beyond all that, so you have your news values there, but there's also the logistical considerations. The media works in very habitual, set in their ways type of mode, just like a lot of other businesses. So we need to make sure that we schedule events at a place and time where the media can just get there. Like I was a reporter for several years, so I'll tell you, never have an event between 9 and 10:30 in the morning, because that's when the TV stations and the newspapers are in meetings where they decide what they're going to cover for the day. Little things like that. So having events on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays is the best. Avoiding Fridays especially and weekends, there's fewer reporters working, and there's fewer people who are paying attention to the news. So in addition to making it harder for them to get there, you'd be hitting less people. The ideal time of day to have an event would be between 11 a.m. And 1 to 2, around 11 a.m. or between 1 and 2 p.m. If you get late in the afternoon, people are going to need to be writing their stories already instead of out covering our events. The one exception to that is if there's going to be a live event that you want to put on during the television news. And prayer vigils are a good example of that, especially if you have candlelight. That's a time where you would do it at night for the benefit of the cameras. But other than prayer vigils with that kind of glow-in-the-dark visual element, always try to have it in the late morning or early afternoon. When you're putting together your plan, you've got your news values, and you've got your location, and you've got your time. Turnout. Now, once you have those logistics taken care of, you need to figure out, like, how many people are going to come. And it's important to estimate it accurately. If you say that you're going to have a march with 100 people, make sure that before you say that close to 100 people would actually come. If you overestimate how many people are going to be there, the story might say, oh, and very few people or fewer people than expected came to this march today. So, and also your credibility with reporters is a really important thing to keep in mind. If they know that when you say 50 people are going to come, that, you know, 40 to 60 people are going to come, they're going to be more likely to come out the next time you have an event. So making sure that you're not exaggerating is really important, and also making sure that your number of people rises to the level of newsworthiness. If you're going to have a march that 12 people are coming to, that wouldn't quite rise to the level of newsworthiness. If you've got 50 or 60 people in an area where there's not typically very large marches of many hundreds, then that's good enough. And if you're going to have hundreds of people, you're going to get cameras. So thinking, if you have a couple dozen or people or less at an event, the news is going to be harder to get. It's not impossible. If you have scores of people, you have a pretty good chance. And if you have hundreds of people, unless you're trying to fill a church that seats thousands, you're going to look good and you're going to get coverage. Now, when you're planning your events, just as important as taking care of those elements that I've just gone over is appropriately notifying the media that things are coming. You alert the media. There's a couple of elements. One is you want to give them advance notice in a document that's called a media advisory. All that really is an email that I conceive of it as an invitation to your event. Say you're addressing it to a reporter or an editor, and the purpose of that is to present the logistical details of your event and a short pitch as to why they would want to cover it, what makes it newsworthy. So you want to email your first media advisory, and we'll go over an example of what a properly formatted media advisory looks like in a second. But you email it to them several days in advance of the event and on the day of the event. Like with the press conference that we had today with clergy and with Richard Trumka, we first sent out the media advisory about that on Monday, and then we sent it out again early this morning to make sure that it was still on people's radar. And in addition to emailing people the media advisory, call them up, calling up the assignment desks at the newspapers, calling up the reporters and the reporters at the newspapers, and being polite and asking them if they would be able to come to this today is a good thing to do. Many times, just making that extra pitch and giving people that personal attention it makes all the difference in the world. And sometimes the reporters' phone numbers are on the newspaper's website. Sometimes they're not. And when they're not, you can contact people at IIC or at Faith in Public Life, and we can help find them for you. Okay, so now the slide we're on is an example of what a media advisory looks like. Now, you'll notice up in the top left corner, there is a date and the name of a contact person and a phone number, and if there was an email address, it would be on there, too. So on the top left corner, you want to have the date and the contact information for whoever's going to be your point person to make sure media comes. It should be probably the same person who's sending the media advisory by email. So you'll notice there's a bold headline that says, what's happening and who's coming? And you see it's one sentence long. And then there's a little italicized sub-headline after that that explains just one more bit of context. And then there's a paragraph that explains very briefly the significance of the event, why you're doing it, and where it's happening and when. And then below that, which is on a second slide, there's a sort of a table broken out of what, who, when and where. And just one sentence each say, what, this media availability at the Capitol. Who, and then you say who's going to be there and their faith, their congregations and their titles. And then when, you make sure the day, the date, and the entire time span. And where, and then on the where line you give the address as well as the name of the place. So a headline, one paragraph detailing why you're doing it, and then a what, who, where, when list is what properly formatted media advisory looks like. And again, we have slides that'll be available after the call that show visually what that looks like. So the person who's sending that, who's sending the media advisory should be someone who serves as like kind of the organizer of the event. One person should be the point of contact for the media. If one person is fielding the calls and one person is sending and receiving the emails, it's a lot easier to keep track of who's been contacted, and it's a lot easier to keep track of who's going to come. Now that can be a lot of work. So one of the qualifications to be the organizer of a media event is someone who can devote their full attention to it on the day of and hopefully the day before the event. The person who's the organizer needs to be really punctual and really reliable and in terms of they answer their phone. Reporters live in a very time-crunched world, and having somebody who can answer their questions right away or return their call right away can make a difference between whether we get covered and whether we don't. So someone who is a good communicator and someone who has good command of the issue, and I know there's no shortage of experts on immigration policy on this call. You just want to make sure. So if you're going to be an organizer, that's encouraging to me. Or if you're going to deputize somebody else, just make sure it's someone who knows what they're talking about in terms of policy and can field the basic questions. So, and the other role besides the organizer and media contact is somebody who is going to manage the speakers at an event. If there's a march or there's a press conference, you're going to have clergy, hopefully, who can speak, or families who are affected, who can speak about the issue. Somebody needs to make sure that they know exactly where and when they have to be. Somebody who can vouch for the fact that the speakers are going to be on time, and can make sure that they're going to be on message. Being in front of the cameras when the cameras start rolling and having absolute confidence that that person's going to say what you guys agreed in advance they're going to cover is really important to maintaining message discipline. And that's something that hopefully either an organizer or somebody else can help people with as to not write their remarks verbatim, but say, okay, these are the notes that we want to talk about. Now the messaging itself, there's elements to it that make the difference between yes, this is going to be a pro-immigration reform, pro-family, pro-justice, faithful message, or this is something that is confusing. The core message is what you want to lead with in any remarks. It's a simple argument that you want the audience to remember an hour after they read the story, or half an hour after they hear it on the news. The one thing that you want them to remember so that they'll tell their friend, that's your core message. And getting that core message across should be the primary tactical goal of any interaction with the media, because studies show that people are not going to remember 12 talking points that are read from a podium. They're going to remember the one main idea. And effective core messages, they have specific characteristics. They're personal. They're not talking about just visas and quotas. They're talking about people who are affected, especially families. Effective messages are moral and/or religious. They're concrete, they're simple, they're specific, and they're brief. If it takes half a minute to say the core message, that's not a core message. Core messages should be just a couple of sentences long and short enough to where you can speak the entire thing before a host would get a chance to interrupt you. So the core messaging, I have some examples here of messaging that have been used, that I've seen in the media that I thought has worked well. So an example of a core message on immigration is, even if you're not born in America, you can be an American. Hardworking immigrants are strengthening our communities, and they deserve a chance to become citizens. Congress needs to create a roadmap to citizenship for new Americans right now, ensure that families are treated with fairness and dignity. There's fairness and dignity. Those are values. You're talking about people who are in our communities. We're talking about being an American. These are all things that are resonant with people who don't understand the issues and don't really think about the issues in great depth like you all do. Sort of reaching the unreached or the unchurched, if you will, you do with messages like that. And then supporting messages, let's say you were writing remarks for a speaker. The core message would be that the very first thing you say. And then you would have supporting messages beneath that. And the supporting messages are additional talking points that reinforce the central point of your core message. So a supporting point, one type of supporting point is something that further elaborates on the faith angle. So I would say people of faith believe we're all precious in the eyes of God, and Scripture tells us to welcome the immigrant. Providing a roadmap to citizenship and prioritizing family unity fundamentally reflect those beliefs. Bringing a faith context is simple. I always assume that I'm talking to someone who doesn't have religious literacy. So talking about specific scripture references and very long parallels in scripture is not as clear a way to go. If you want to make it very simple, I was at a media training when somebody was talking about Mary and Joseph as an immigration story. It took 2 seconds, and it was instantly resonant with people who don't know anything, who know very little about religion. So, if you're adding a specifically religious message, I'd encourage you to make it something as familiar as possible to the culture at large. Besides having a faith-specific message, having a policy ask for us is really important because we're in the middle of a policy debate right now. So those are some important elements of messaging, and some specific examples of those will be available later. Now, talking points and clever lines are one thing, and facts, those are helpful, but nothing is, from a messaging perspective, nothing is as powerful as a personal story. If you have direct experience with, like, the brokenness of our immigration system and the destruction it causes, as either an immigrant yourself or a relative or someone who works with immigrants, sharing a very compelling short story is a great way to get it across. And you want to lead with the people, with the names of the people who are affected, rather than setting any context. And you want to be really, really brief. And injustice and harm and innocence are things to all touch on. And avoiding any information that doesn't reflect well on the people you're talking about is really important too. For instance, one time I was listening at a media event to a priest telling stories about how a married couple in his congregation were separated. The husband was in Mexico and the wife was in the United States, but he included information about the husband's criminal past and struggles with substance abuse. It would have been a perfect story if he had not included the details that reflect poorly on people. So make sure that your protagonist is portrayed in a completely positive light. Now, I realize I want to make sure that we have plenty of time left for the people who are going to be talking about their specific stories. So I just want to there's a couple other key elements about, like, letters to editors and op-eds, but I'd like to just put the brakes on that and make that available later through the sharing of the slides. So I think I've taken a little more time than was allotted to me. So I'll just step aside for a minute and let the people who have been doing these best practices talk about their work. Is that okay, Jen?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, Dan. I really appreciate it. And we are going to have Reverend Israel Alvaron speak, and he's going to give some great examples of his work. Reverend Alvaron was the National Economic Justice Organizer for the United Methodist Church and a faith organizer for Unite Here, and so brings a great depth of background working with the media and doing grassroots organizing. So he's going to share with us a little bit about his media experience, and then we'll also open it up for questions and answers. So, Reverend Alvaron, if you haven't already, if you can press *6 to unmute your line, and we would love to hear from you.
Yes, can you hear me?
We can, yes. Thanks so much.
Okay, perfect. So I'm very glad to be on this call. I'm also learning a lot because I never did formal training on media. But Nora and I have worked on some campaigns and used a lot of religious symbols. We call it faith-rooted symbols, you know, and organizing, where we actually harness and make full use of whatever symbols of music that we have as a religious community, of which we have very rich resources, to be able to convey our message, I think, which is the intention of a media event that we've been discussing. I have some examples that that I have personally been part of or organized with other people over the last, since, I guess, 2004. And before I share them, I just say that all these actions were planned with the religious leaders. They had ownership over it. They had their parts parceled out to everybody, and sometimes they would have long theological discussions as to what message would be interfaith and what, you know. An example would be foot washing. We did foot washing. Me and Noel did it for hospital and university workers at the UC system here in California. And sometimes we had to go through a theological discussion of whether it's even okay for rabbis to participate in what is obviously a Christian practice of Holy Thursday foot washing. But the rabbi said, well, back in the day, even in Israel, you know, if you're coming out of the desert, you want your foot washed as a form of welcome. And so we agreed, and so we had rabbis and Christian clergy do foot washing, which we also did here in California just this past week, across California in different places where we had chapters of our Interfaith Committee for Work and Justice to pray and wash the feet of immigrants. Another good action would be around Passover, so I'm just glad, you know, saying all the actions that you can do on a religious holiday. Over Passover, we have done marches that celebrate the symbols of Passover. I've heard of actions where they would offer a manager or the boss some of the symbols of Passover just to highlight the oppression of people. That's a good sign. And then it's more public because everybody sees it at a march, but then it also becomes a private delegation when you actually confront the boss or whoever is the, I don't want to call it target, but for other people, they say the target. Hanukkah is also a good time. It's around Christmas, and so we've done an action before where we both had Hanukkah and Christmas together. We had, you know, if you light candles in a public square, it's not really going to be seen. So what we did was we used sticky torches on bamboo poles, and the rabbis loved it because they probably haven't seen, like, you know, a large, basically candle lighting, but it's like we use sticky torches. And we marched the tiki torches singing holiday carols that we changed the lyrics to, and we had a Christmas card or a holiday card to be presented to whoever the target was. We also did bread and roses before. It's probably not religious. Some people would connect that with the janitors campaign and also the movie. Bread is supposedly for the basic necessities of people, and also roses for human dignity. But you can easily spin that from a religious perspective, right? Because bread is very much a symbol for Christians, you know, in the same way that human dignity can be shown in many ways, and flowers are just, like, you know, basic. Praying over, I remember at an ICE headquarters here in San Francisco, where they also have, I think, a jail. We've done praying over their walls, and it's a good visual because you can see people crying and praying and touching the side of the building on the sidewalk. That was a good media patch. Also, we've done a wailing wall if there's no wall available. We've done this at federal buildings where you can't even get close to the building. We'd set up a wailing wall. And then lastly, water, I think, is a universal symbol for cleansing, you know. And for Christians, it's baptism. So we did an action in front of ICE before, and it was in response to a big raid that happened here right after May Day. And so the community had a big action, but the religious component of that action got the press headlines because we used water as a symbol, and the picture that was shown all over the place was clergy pouring water over the building, in front of the building, and some of the guards to celebrate, you know, that people have been baptized, and therefore they are unique, they are blessed. And so it was also somewhat a cleansing of the policies of the government around immigration. So those are some of the actions that I'd like to share with you, and Noel and Jen could share my contact if you have any more information that you need. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much, Reverend Alvaron. This is really helpful and I think really helps, you know, pique my interest in terms of how can we make our events more not only media worthy, but also deeper and more theologically creative. So I really appreciate that a lot. So we have 8 more minutes for questions. And to remind everyone, if you have a question, you can press *6 to unmute your line. Any questions for Dan from Faith and Public Life, or for me or Noel on federal or state updates, or for Reverend Alvaron on his work in particular? So we'll open up the line for questions, and again, please press *6 to unmute your line to ask a question. Great. Well, it sounds like everyone was very thorough. I know we have a whole bunch of folks on the line and some folks on the webinar portion, but I will say that if you have other questions, please feel free to be in touch with us. You should have my email if no one else's, and I'm sure you have other folks' emails to please be in touch with. There is a list of IIC contacts on this last slide that I'll leave up for a little while. But thank you for joining the call, and I hope it was helpful. And if there are additional questions that people have, please be in touch, and I can definitely put folks in touch with Dan or Reverend Alvaron as well. So thank you so much, and we'll talk with you on our next call, which will be on May 6th at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll be back to the usual, first Monday of the month and time at that point. So thanks so much, and we'll be in touch in the meantime.
Thank you, John.